This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Breaking Ground, a podcast about earth-moving machinery and characters in the industry. Both your hosts work for TerraCat, New Zealand's Caterpillar machinery dealer. I'm Richard Clark.
And I'm Marty Turek. In this podcast, we'll hear stories from a wide range of people, and today we're introducing Graham Walker. Graham's been in the industry for over 50 years, starting off as a mechanic after leaving school. He has a long association with the Ministry of Works, more lately, Works Infrastructure, and Downer. And over that time, he's had a close relationship with Cat Machinery and the dealership here in New Zealand. Welcome, Graham.
No, very good. Pleased to be here.
So, Graham, 50 years is a substantial amount of time, and obviously being sort of around mechanics and stuff like that. So where did your interest start in mechanics?
Well, I suppose, silly enough, my mother told me that she feels that I started my interest in mechanics while she was on her way to the maternity annex because the car wouldn't start and the old man had to crank his bloody heart out to try and get it going and push it to get it going, and finally got her into the hospital, and yep, here I am. Graham was born. And she said, she cursed and everything while waiting for this car to start. So maybe that was an early start for me, to be fair. And really, if I go on from there and look at my school days and school years, I used to enjoy sport. English wasn't a favourite subject, but I enjoyed mathematics and all that sort of stuff. So I went through my primary school years right through to my high school years, and I actually stayed for to sit my school C in high school. And anyway, in due course, I got given the notice of whether I've passed or failed, and I did. I failed big time. Scored pretty well in mathematics, I'd have to say, but the rest of it was pretty ho-hum. So I took those results home and found an old glass jar with a lid on it and took a spade down to the orchard garden and area and dug a hole and buried my school C results. A couple of weeks later, Mum said to me, "Hey, what happened about your results?" And I said, "Oh, they weren't very good." "Oh, I'd like to have a look at them, you know." And I said, "Well, a bit late. I've got rid of them. I dug them in the garden." So that's how that actually transpired with my results. But funny enough, because we were on a family farm, and my eldest brother, He took over the farm, and obviously he had children, and they heard the story about this Uncle Graham school C results dug around in the garden, and those kids dug, they never found them. And believe it or not, they've actually now got children, so we've got at least two generations digging around for my school C results, which was quite amazing.
So where did those, they're obviously failing school C, where did that lead you in terms of your next steps?
Well, to be honest, I was always a tinkerer. I loved, I pulled the lock apart on Dad's car shed door, and to see how it worked, how the key worked and all that. And, I managed to figure that out and did a few things like that. I really stumbled on the old clock. You know the old clocks used to wind them up, and they had two bells on the top for the alarm. Well, I'd have to say that wasn't a success, and the frigging alarm never ever worked, and it never actually read the correct time. But from there, and I think it might have been a little bit with Dad's help, had the opportunity to go and work in a garage in Dannevirke. That's where we were from. And the garage was called O'Hagan's Garage. And Bruce O'Hagan had it. It was a little old garage, had no franchise, so everything was old that come in. And, you know, Model A cars, I worked on those, and hay balers and trucks and all sorts of machinery. And, I just loved it. And remember my first job, which was working on a Ford Prefect. And then the end of the week came, Bruce O'Hagan, the guy that owned the garage, he gave me a brown envelope. And he says, this is yours, Graham. And I opened it up, and there's £4.02 inside it. And I thought, what's this, Bruce? And he said, no, that's your pay for the week. And I thought, I don't want to get paid. I just love what I was doing, you know. But I must admit that never went that much further than that, because I did used to like getting my weekly pay, but I absolutely loved that side of my job. It was fantastic.
So I suppose that was your beginnings from a mechanical perspective. And then from there you went to the Ministry of Works. Was that's right, isn't it?
Sort of. I actually went away over to Australia for a big long holiday and came back, and I actually ended up in Hamilton and got a job with Winstones, their concrete plant. And I did that for 2 or 3 years, and then ventured back into working for a guy in Dannevirke, again driving trucks. And I had about 4 years driving trucks, carting export logs from Taupo through to Mount Maunganui. But as time went on, at the end of that 4 years, the forestry was going into quite a recession, and I'd already had a new home built, had a loan through state advances, and the interest rates was just on 22%. So with the forestry going slightly downhill in a big way, an opportunity came along for me to work for a company called J.S. Burrows in Taupo as a mechanic. Really, that was a really good part of my career. I loved it. I had 18 years there, and then finally the lady that owned it sold the business to Works Infrastructure. And then eventually Downer bought the old Works side of the business.
So you would have been, a part of a fair few infrastructure projects through the years with Downer, or with Works as it was, and then Downer. Do you have a favourite project or maybe one or two that stand out in the memory?
With the Downer was chasing overseas markets, and they got a project to rebuild the outer Vanuatu, all the outlining roading network. Let's say you'd call it like State Highway 1 in Vanuatu. So that was a major job for us to get involved in. And the guy that was running that as a GM, his name is Jeff Oldman. He actually came out to see me at Takanini. We're at the Downer's yard at Takanini, and explain what was going to happen on this job. And he painted a pretty good picture, because when he went away, I got my troops at Takanini Depot together and I said to them, hey, this is a job that has happened, and I'd like to think that our Takanini branch could actually project manage the organising the equipment to go to this project. So we're talking a huge, large amount of equipment and materials. So the project hired one of the Seato barges in Auckland, which I don't know what the measurements, but it could be 100 metres long by 60 metres wide. And that total bottom deck was filled up with sealing aggregate and aggregate for the chip sealing, and through the centre crossways in the barge we filled that with containers. So that was like everything you would need on a project, from, you know, shovels, jackhammers, survey equipment, linear down to toilet paper, you know, everything that you would use on a project. And those containers were all full right to the top with that, and in the centre, which divided the aggregate. And then on top of the aggregate, we then put, you know, all the trucks, the water carts, the graders, the bulldozers, rollers, excavators. The whole top of that Seato barge was full with equipment. In actual fact, it was hugely impressive looking when you saw it all together. And there was one of the guys at work, he had a helicopter, and he actually said to us, hey, would you like to go and have a look down at the harbour, see it all lined up, and you better take some photos. So we agreed on that. So there was the office girl, Miriam, and myself, and my Denise decided to go this particular trip. So we went out to the airport and met this young lady, which I thought was going to be the just like the secretary in the office. But it ended up she was the pilot for it. And she was a lovely, lovely lady, but very, very short. And we hopped into the helicopter. Denise and I hopped in the back. Miriam sat in the front. And the first thing she said was, oh, God, I've got to shift the seat all the way forward. I can hardly reach the pedals. And I saw Denise looking at me with a funny look on her face. And then she went to start the helicopter, and it wouldn't start. So she said, oh, excuse me, I'll just go and get the aircraft mechanic to come and have a look at it. Well, at that point, I heard Denise's seatbelt come apart. She leapt out of the seat. She said, no friggin' way I'm flying in this thing. anyway, the mechanic came over, and it was just a little tinkle here, and up we went, and it was a fantastic trip. Right round, and it was neat to see. Took lots and lots of photos and came back nice and safely.
So that barge obviously made its way through up into the islands. Mm-hmm. And what was sort of the next step from there?
Well, some of the guys had gone over previously and made a ramp in a little bit of sort of like a bit of an estuaries area. So we unloaded it all off the beach and had a lay down area, which was, if you can imagine, had a whole lot of cloth put down so the sealing chip could be spread on the, so it didn't get contaminated. So we had, I think we might have had about 36 hours, I don't mean a bit more, to actually unload the whole barge. And that's to unload it, clean it up, sweep it, and cut off any things that we'd welded to the deck. And if not, every hour over that was $1,000 cost for the barge sitting there. So we worked through, you know, basically all day, all night, shifting everything off and getting it. Yeah, it was a big achievement, really, to do it. It was huge. Mm.
And how long did that project go on for in terms of that roading job that it was?
I would imagine it could have been 18 months, might have been 2 years. Bear in mind, the road was virtually, you'd say it was originally just like a one-way traffic, huge amount of potholes. So, you know, it wasn't just doing the road. We had to do all the drainage, you know, all the culverts, and it ended up, you know, it was it would be the equivalent of a country road in New Zealand where two cars could pass. You know, I heard the guys say that, you know, after it had been opened, or actually prior before it had been opened, the guys spent time at the local schools talking to the school children about the difference in traffic, because you can imagine beforehand they would only be going slow. Now they're probably doing 50 to 80 odd kilometres an hour. Mm. So there was a lot of training that Jeff and the team put into, you know, safety as far as locals go, you know?
Yeah, and I understand that project had a bit of a family connection for yourself as well.
Well, not that one. That was another project. We went to the Solomon Islands. We went to one of the northwestern islands, an island called Munda. And that was to redo an airstrip. So the airstrip had originally been put in, I think it may have been put in by the Japanese, and then during about 1943, the Australian, New Zealand, and I think American, there was a massive fight there to reclaim that airport. And in actual fact, for me, my dad was in the Solomon Islands, and he was part of that area that he was in during the war. So for me, it was really quite a neat experience to go there and walk on a bit of ground that he had walked on, and thankfully got back alive, you know. But that was the Munda project, and the reason of that project was the planes that used to come out of Australia could only take a certain amount of weight. They had to totally refuel them, and very little freight, because if they got up to the mainland of the Solomons, Honiara, I think is the main airport there, and if there was something wrong at the airport, they had to have enough fuel to get back. So by lengthening this Munda Airport gave them a safety net if something went wrong. So, it was, again, that was a huge job by Downer, and New Zealand government had quite a lot to do with that.
And I understand that you, as you were doing some of the excavations for that project, you found some interesting remnants from the Second World War as part of that.
Yeah, well, before we could actually start, you know, with talking with locals, I dare say Jeff and them would have done, they had to get an overseas ordnance team in there to do a lot of checking for unexploded or you know, spent shells. The number went into thousands that they found, and even bombs that hadn't gone off. So these guys, they worked on that area and got it all safe before we could shift even a piece of ground. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly something that you wouldn't come across normally with any normal project. So
yeah.
Now, you've had a long relationship with New Zealand's Caterpillar dealer. Yeah. Does that date back to the Gough Gough and Hamer days?
Yeah, it would do. I when I was with J.S. Burrows in Taupo, we had some cat machines. To be honest, didn't have many. Most of the graders were cats. And we used to have dealings with Artie Rankin. He was the parts and the guy that used to call into to the customers, and met up with Hardy, and we were amazing bugger. He's retired now. I think he's got interests in other things that you put into bottles and let it wait for a while and then you drink it into wine. But he, so through my time right up until Artie retired, him and I had a really close relationship. Mm.
And so obviously over your time you've had a couple of very interesting projects, Graham, around sort of that sort of thing. Now, you came in and worked for us at TerraCat, and I believe you're involved in a pretty significant project for the New Zealand Army. Can you tell us a bit about that project?
That was interesting. I was working at TerraCat, or Goss it was then, in Palmerston North, and I was project managing a few things there. In actual fact, they got me project managed to putting a new 450-ton track press into the Palmerston North depot and get that set up, because it was only the one in the country to do all the big D10s and D11s track gear. So I put that together for them, and then the manager at that time, Wayne Morgan, he said to me, "Hey, we've got another project coming along with the Army. Would you be interested?" So he gave me a very short brief, which raised my eyebrows, because they were looking for a machine that could go into the water in a meter and a half depth of water, and not only just normal water, salt water in the sea, because the Navy has landing crafts that bring equipment to the beach, and sometimes they get stuck and need to be towed and pushed. But the more I looked at that, the detail in that contract, and then was set up with a meeting in Trentham with the Defence Force and the guys that were ahead of that project for the Defence Force, it really grew on me. I could see how we could make it work, and not only just me, talking with our key guys at work. We had Arthur Galloway and Josh Johnson and Louis Holmes. We thrashed it out and we got it together, and it was a delight to be able to do all the modifications and suggest modifications, test them. They all had to be tested 100%, and so they should for the Defence Force, and see it go through to its end result. And then on the back of that, they wanted another machine to replace like a D5 they used to use for pushing the barges in and out. And they were looking at a D6, which we would have been happy for a D6. But to be honest, when we measure a D6 and measure a metre and a half of water, that is actually over the total engine. The engine would be totally submerged in water. So from there, we led them towards a skidder, and we actually had a 555D close by, and we did some trials down at Himatangi, and the Defence Force came along to have a look, and we had Omar, our cat trainer, demonstrated it, and honestly and truly, within 2 hours, 3 hours, they gave me a phone call back and said, "Yep, this is a machine." And we had some extensive modifications on that machine. And again, that went for trials and absolutely outperformed the whole project. The Defence Force was wrapped. And in actual fact, on the back of that, we were told that the TerraCat was going to be nominated for an award for the work they'd done on producing these two, well, they're actually four machines, two loaders and two skidders.
And Graham, what was that award that you guys were nominated for?
Well, they have awards every year, and our name was put in the the Terek Hat name was put in the hat for this award. So we were one of four companies, and just to get into the top four was a huge success, and we. Yeah, the company celebrated that. Unfortunately, we didn't make the final in that, but we were recognised. Obviously, the recognition from the Defence Force was there. This seems a bit funny, but on the day nominated, Defence Force nominated myself and presented me with an award for the project management that had gone on for this whole army infrastructure deal. I was blown away, but, you know, I look at it, I accepted the award, but it wasn't just me. It was the Arthur, you know, the Josh and the Louis guys that I mentioned earlier. We were all part of it, but it is... I must admit, I look at it from time to time and think to myself, that was really, really neat.
It's a really impressive accolade, and I can imagine there's some incredible lessons and stuff that you picked up along the way and some things that you learnt along the way.
Yeah, you know, I'm not bloody perfect Pete or anything. You know, I've made mistakes, you know, from mechanical mistakes I could share with you, one that I had. Years ago, we had a grader, a 760 grader. It had a 92V Detroit engine in it, it was out in Lake Taupo Forest working. I went there to check it because the driver said something was wrong. I got there, had a look, and I found that one of the internal ejector pipes had broken off and it was pumping raw diesel into the sump. So, you know, I repaired the pipe, drained the oil, put new oil in it, and away I went. And really, in hindsight, and I know it now, it was a mistake. At that point, I should have done all that, put it on a transporter, and brought it back into the workshop, because that machine probably only went for another 40 hours, 50 hours at most, and then it ran all the bearings in the engine. And I've actually seen that happen since then, and guys never actually told me about it. And if they'd asked me, I could have actually told them, stop it, transport the blimmin' thing back, pull it apart, and you'll save it. That was probably one of the failures. Yeah, not a nice one, but I've taken it on the chin.
Yeah, something that you certainly always learn from, and you can pass that knowledge on to others as well, which is always really invaluable.
Yeah.
Now, you talked earlier about Artie Rankin, a long-time GOF employee, and a lot of people out there will know Artie, but you must have come across plenty of other characters who are pretty memorable over your, you know, 50-odd years in the industry. Is there anyone else that sort of you can think of that you could tell our listeners about?
Oh, yeah. Well, when we were with Downer and I got transferred to Hamilton to be the regional plant manager for the Waikato, when I moved into there, they had cranes. They had a crane division. And in there was a guy by the name of Russell Ratimer. And unfortunately, Russell has passed away probably about 3 or 4 years ago. Boy, you know, it was just shocking. But him and I clicked really well in that crane business as a separate part of our normal business. And he was a real good bugger, you know, likes of... there's some stories I cannot repeat, but he was huge knowledge in that man, and in the crane industry, and his son Aaron is taken over from and is and now with the Downer fleet has actually become quite a huge crane fleet, you know. But there's all sorts of characters you run across, you know, in the our industry, you know.
So it sounds like you've definitely met a lot of very interesting people along the way. So you've seen quite a few changes, I can imagine, in the 50 years that you've been in and around the industry. So what's some of the biggest changes that you've seen sort of in that time period, or some of the sort of most notable things that you've noticed change in that time period, just generally across the industry?
The top one's got to be health and safety. That has changed. You know, probably some of us look at it and think that it might have gone over the top too far the other way. But to be fair, your workforce, you know, the old cliche, has got to get home safe every night, no matter what you do. And, there's a whole lot goes into safety. And for myself, probably my key thing that I look at with safety is, young people, children around machinery, you know, just keep an eye on them. You know, they get excited when they see a truck or a piece of machinery, but you know, you just got to keep an eye on them. And I was only just the other day, I was with a young person and new to the business, and we went out to an excavator, and the excavator had its tail facing towards us, and I said, "Hey, we just stop here. We don't move any closer to this machine because there's a grey area, or let's say a dark area around every piece of equipment where you should not put your foot into that area until the operator actually physically sees you. And you actually stand there, put your hand up, and they recognise they may carry on digging, but when they're ready, they'll swing around, lower the bucket, lower the blade, whatever, and then that's the point that you can actually go and talk to the people. All right.
That's some really good advice for sort of young people who aren't familiar with the industry and that sort of thing as well. Sort of, yeah. We hear about too many sort of horror stories. So
yeah. The other key thing that I just absolutely loved was the introduction of PronicLink. So that's living up the machines that would report back, you know, to TerraCat, or you log on yourself and you can monitor the machines. And we were actually doing a large project and with another company, and the machines were all being charged by the hour. And we started off day one and we read all the hour meters, come to the end of the month, go and read all the hour meters again and submit a claim. And a number of the claims were forced back because the hours didn't match up. Like I said, I'm talking 1 or 2 hours. Yeah, it wasn't set up right. And this project was going to go on for 18 months. And at that time, through my association with Goffs, the team at Goffs had actually introduced me to PronicLink. So it was, it was an on-machine reporting system. So it didn't take us too long to catch up with, Louis Coutts from Terra, and we set every asset we had up with PronicLink and set it up, got it up and running. So it meant that at the end of the month, we just downloaded an Excel spreadsheet and went as a claim, And from that day on, there was never, ever one claim rejected. So I took that technology a bit further, and I dare say if Louis was here, he would pull his hair out for some of the daft things I would ask about getting reports out of the system, which he went through and he actually developed them. And to be honest, some of them still would be very much alive today. If I was a machine operator and had a few machines, that's the way I'd be going, because it just keeps you completely up to date on the track, on the movement of the machines when they're due for servicing. It's brilliant, brilliant piece of equipment.
Graham, over your sort of tenure in the industry, you must have seen a very wide range of different machines and stuff, from obviously sort of semi-amphibious right the way through to large stuff in that as well. Have you got a favourite sort of machine, or what's your sort of favourite that stands out?
They're all favourites. I love them all, really.
I think there were some days where they weren't your favourite.
yeah, there were in my early days. But I'd have to, you know, for the company's sake, be pretty proud of the work we did for the Defence Force, those two machines. I don't think we've seen the end of that with those. I think... because they are all tied in with you know, NATO and all that sort of stuff between, you know, New Zealand, Australia, and all that, and you know, hopefully that knowledge is being shared around, and we'd be more than excited. We're really excited if something went more for that, but that would happen to be our best ones.
And talking of special machines, you are currently restoring an old Cat D2.
Yep.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, my nephew, Barry, he's got some machines in his yard. He does a lot of transporting and all that. And he must have thought I was looking a bit glum or something one day, because he said to me, "Hey, Uncle, I think I've got a project for you to do." I said, "Oh, what are you looking at, mate?" He said, "I got a D2. You want to come and have a look?" So I went up to his yard in Napier, and he was a D2. It's a 5U 15200, so it's a reasonably late one of the, towards the later models of them. But it was in pretty poor shape, and he got it dragged onto the transporter, brought it down to home, I couldn't put it into my workshop because I'd already spent a huge amount of money on resealing my total driveway. So we had to park it in the paddock. So where it came off the transporter, I started stripping it into chunks that I could finally move around. So it's been a project that's gone on for, be getting close to 18 months now, I suppose, and I've now got it virtually fully assembled in my workshop. And so I tell you what, I have loved every minute of it, to bloody go out there in the shed and just work away for an hour or two, pull things apart, because it was completely seized up in the clutches and the brakes, steering brakes and that. It took quite a bit of sitting and nutting out how we could actually pull it apart. But as of the moment, it's sitting in the shed up on blocks, and the little donkey engine goes, the big engine goes. I've had it sitting there with the sprockets all turning backwards and forwards. So my next trick over the next 2 or 3 months is put the tracks on, lay some planks down, get it out of the shed, into the paddock, and I don't know what will happen after that, to be honest.
Well, you'll have to keep us posted on that. It's, I suppose it's you've come full circle from back in the day tinkering with locks and clocks and the like. And yeah, it'd be good to see that that D2 actually, you know, at a show or something like that in the near future.
Mm. Mm.
Thanks, Graham, for coming on Breaking Ground. It's been great chatting with you today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. And Marty and Richard, I'm jumping out of my skin to have this opportunity to talk to you guys. Really, really neat. Now, I've listened to some of the others, and wow, you guys are doing a really good job. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. We do appreciate it. And thanks so much to you, our listeners. We hope you've enjoyed today's conversation with Graham.
And we'd also love your feedback. So get in touch. You can message us on any one of our TerraCat social media channels. And also keep an eye on TerraCat's Facebook page for details about next month's episode of Breaking Ground. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks a lot.